Guys, could you just flip my computer over? It's there, thank you. So what we're doing is we're looking at the book of Revelation, chapters 2 and 3. And the book of Revelation, particularly the 2 and 3, Jesus writes a letter to seven churches, okay then? And he's got things to say, he's got encouraging things to say. He's got, at times, quite criticism for some of the churches because they're not doing so well. His other churches are doing much better. But he's there to really just challenge them and to motivate them and to help them. We didn't do this last week because we had our guest missionary speakers and who were just amazing. We tend not to mention them publicly because they minister and work in quite a secure area of the world, and we have to respect their security. So we tend not to mention them. But for those who were here last week, they have made it clear, if you want to sign up to the newsletter, then that will come through a third source and we'll get that to you. And they really, they love Elam, obviously. They were a part of our church when they were here as students, and they've gone out into the mission field. So we're going to look at the second of those churches. And but just to get an overview of all the letters, all seven letters have the same characteristics. And I won't go over this every week. This is the second week for this wee bit of an intro. So all the letters have the same formula. I can't to describe the person who's sending a letter, which Jesus. So Jesus always says something about himself, the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the one who died. And so he always says something about himself to remind each of those churches about his supremacy and his kingship and who he is. And then he either gives them a compliment or a criticism. Some of the five of the churches get a compliment and a criticism. Only two of the churches don't have any criticism, and only two of the churches don't have any compliment. Okay, then. But five of them get a compliment and a critique as well. And then Jesus follows that up with a command that of what each church has to do in order to go to the next level. And then he tells each of those churches that they have to remain faithful and they have to remain committed. And then at each of each letter, there's this little phrase, let the churches hear what the Spirit is saying to the churches. And I put out a call to you 2 weeks ago and asked you to do me a favor. And in your prayer times, if you could ask God what it is he's saying to your Caleb. Because God doesn't just want to speak to the churches in Turkey 2,000 years ago. He wants to speak to the churches in York, in the living and in the present age. And so God is, and God, so that phrase, let him who hears, hear what the Spirit is saying to the churches. And I've been asking you to ask God what it is he's saying to our church. And if you get anything at all, then come back to me on that. I don't want to just be the sole spokesperson for God in this church. There was a funny story really in the book of Exodus. So God says, get the people together tomorrow. I'm going to come down the mountain. I'm going to have a chat with them all. And when God, so they're all at the base of the mountain. And when God turned up, they kind of freaked them out a little bit. And they all scattered and ran away. And then they came back to Moses and said, Moses, we've got a better idea. Rather than us meet God, could you go and meet him on our behalf and tell us what he said? But the idea is that God wants to speak to you. Because he's a God of revelation. He's personal and he's intimate. And he's got words to speak to you for all of us. Because we're a family. So I'm asking you to take time out and hear what God is saying. Each of the letters, interesting enough, and I don't want us to lose this. And you'll have to read through the two chapters to get it. But all the letters start with this little phrase, I know. You may have not noticed that before. I know. And I just want to say, I think that's a wonderful phrase because God knows. He knows your situation. He knows what you're going through. He knows the hardships. He knows the pain. He knows the difficulties. And he knows. And so there's nothing that's happening in life. There's nothing that's happening in your private life, in your church life, in your work life, in your medical and health life that God doesn't know about. He knows. He is the God who knows. He knows all things. So don't let what he knows embarrass you or to frighten you. It's a comforting statement. God knows. And it's not just an exclamation, God knows. It's God really knows. And out of that comes his care and his compassion and his empathy. And that will really help us in our talk today. He doesn't just know about the church in Smyrna 2,000 years ago. He knows every detail about this church here in the centre of York. So here we are, a little map of the seven churches that God wrote this letter to each of them. All the letters were to be passed around, so he's speaking to all the churches, plural. So each letter has been sent to all seven churches. So everybody's getting a copy of everybody else's letter, okay then. So that there was no saying, there was no mix-up of what God was saying to each of the churches. You may not notice, but if you look at that, sort of almost see that as a circle. The order of letters are Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, and almost going round, almost in a postal route of dropping off these letters of communication. What is God saying to the churches? I don't want you to lose that. What God says to this church in question is going to be important for us today. But what is God saying to the churches? I don't want to spend too much time on the history. I love history and I would spend hours doing this. I'm not going to. But everything that God says in these letters had historical significance for those individual churches. And there's so much little details in here that was relevant to their day, because God knows. And they weren't letters that were just randomly picked out and, you know, seven letters that were kind of thrown around to the church. But God was speaking into the very heart of the situation. Smyrna was an amazing, not capital city, but it was certainly second ranking to Ephesus. It was a really beautiful city. It was called the Glory of Asia. The Glory of Asia. For those of you who are familiar with the geography of Turkey, it is now the modern city of Izmir. Okay then. So if you've been to Izmir, you've been to where Smyrna was. Okay then. The glory, it was seen as an ornamental city. It was expensively rich to live. Rich people lived there. It was a very ornate. It was, for many people, the upper echelons of society. It was rich people who lived here. It had perfect town planning. The architecture and the planning and the stadium and the routes, they weren't built historically over hundreds of years. The whole thing was designed from the outset as a city, a new city build, and we'll talk about that. It had incredible prestige and honour from Rome. Rome gave it special, the freedom of Rome, which means they could have their own proconsuls and their own legal teams and their own governance as well. It had a very, very, very large Jewish population. And that's important for us today. The wealthy, the prosperous, and the successful. Now, take note of these three words that I have used. Wealthy, prosperous, and successful, because that's not where the church was. That the church was in a completely different stage, but in contrast to the people who lived in the city. And again, very important aspect, and I won't hang too long on this, the emperor worship, and this is why they had this special status from Rome. They were really into emperor worship, really into lordship towards the empire and the emperor. And we'll come back to those issues. Why? All of those issues for us today is really important in our study, in terms of the history, the geography, and the makeup of the city. It was perfectly designed from the outset. The theatre held about 20,000 people. The shops, and you can just see the top of these little shopping stalls, were built underneath the stadium. And so you could go underneath and do your shopping when you went for a day out. And they were massively into these sporting events, almost like the Olympics, on a regular basis. Again, very important to our study today. And so people went to the main centre for sporting events and they did their shopping. And it was planned meticulously. And these are these little shopping precincts that are all around the main stadium. What's really important for us is that, that Smyrna did exist up till about 600 BC, and then it was just set on fire. It was completely obliterated, and it lay dormant for 400 years, just in ashes and ruins. And the Greeks decided to rebuild the city, okay? And it was almost said of the city that the city was dead and had come alive again. And that's why they were able to build the city from scratch, because the Greeks decided they were going to literally plant a city. And so the buildings, the architecture, planning, everything was built around this new concept. And what was dead had been brought alive again. And the context of that, again, is very important to us. Emperor worship, the temple to Zeus, to Cybele, to many of the Roman gods and the Greek gods. And so worship, idol worship was massive in the city. Here we have a picture of modern day Izmir. And you can see now that it is, again, around about, I think, 186, there was a massive earthquake which stopped the city again about 200 years into it. And then it's been rebuilt again and brought back to modern life as the city of Izmir. So in two times, it is really the whole city has been wrecked and reinvigorated. And that's really important for our study. So let's look at the letter that God sends to Smyrna, okay then. And if it was in today's world of social media, he may have sent them an email. Okay then. So the email is to the church in Smyrna. York Elam, get a copy of it. Okay, Elam headquarters, get a copy. Okay, and it's from God and to the churches. Write to the angel of the church in Smyrna, the first and the last, the one who is dead and who has come to life again. I know your affliction, your poverty, and yet you are rich. I know the slander of those who say they are Jews, and they are not, but they are of the synagogue of Satan. Don't be afraid of what you're about to suffer. Look, the devil is about to throw some of you in prison to test you, and you will have affliction for... sorry, I've missed out a key word there, I've realised. You'll have affliction for 10 days, that should be. It went off the page. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. Anyone who has an ear should listen to what the Spirit is saying to the churches. The victor will never be harmed by the second death. I'm just going to get some water as we make our way through. Just some key thoughts that will help us be able to listen to what God is saying. The first and the last. The one who was dead and who'd come to life. This would not be lost in the inhabitants of this great city that had come to life again. Having been buried with him, Paul, writing to the Colossian church, says, we, having been buried with him in baptism, are now raised to life. So this idea of renewal, both for the city and for these Christians, is imperative to encourage them and to help them keep going. That God is a God of resurrection. God is a God of renewal. God is a God of replanting and rebuilding and redevelopment. And the inhabitants of this city, there would have been a double whammy, a double message for this. And this is why this emphasis of renewal and new life is of such importance. But destroyed in 600 BC, restored and brought back to life around 280 BC by the Greeks, the first and the last. And I just want us to hold on to those thoughts. He who was dead is now alive. And so Jesus is saying, whatever you're going through, and he's going to have to say some difficult things to this church. There's no criticism of church. They're going to go through a hard time. A bit like our present situation that we're being told all the time in terms of inflation. Jesus has to write to them and saying, things are bad, but they're going to get worse before they get better. And I know that that is a bit of a, nobody wants to hear that in the times we're about to go into recession, where inflation is going through the roof. People are feeling discouraged. People are feeling that something is dying within them. And Jesus, the great resurrector, has come into their midst. And he's saying, I know what it is to die, and I know what it is to be alive again. And I am standing in your midst, and whatever you have to go through, I'm going to go through it with you. I'm going to carry you, and I'm going to help you, and I'm going to encourage you. The writer to the book of Hebrews says, we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but one who is able to intercede for us. And he has been tempted in every way, just as we are, and yet he did not succumb to sin. But Jesus knows how hard it is. Fundamentally, that's what he's saying. He understands and he empathizes and he cares. He gets it. He knows. Jesus knows what you are going through. And he has to say to them, guys, don't give up. Be faithful. Stay the course. And we live in our context in these days is very much as people are very short-sighted. They live for instant pleasure. They live for the moment. If something doesn't work, they move on to the next thing. And Jesus said, don't do that. Stay the course. Fight the good fight. Hang on in there. And for some of you, the end may seem disastrous, but it's not. It's the beginning of life. For anyone who does not take up his cross is not worthy to follow me. And it's difficult for those of us who live in the West and with as much Christian freedom as any era has ever experienced. But there are people today who will die because of their faith. A persecuted church. They will have to make decisions and they will have to give up their lives for the King. And for many of us, we live in relative comfort. There is a likelihood that persecution can come through political oppression and through the distortion of biblical message, that we will have to make, our movement and our churches will have to make difficult decisions in the future. And so even though we live in a time of relative safety, it's becoming more difficult for the church to have a voice. But I don't think that's going to get any easier in the future. And Jesus is saying to you and I and to our movement and to the church in the West, don't give up. Don't be discouraged. Keep on going. There are three things I just want to draw out and hopefully take 10 or so minutes to do this before our conclusion. Jesus talks about their afflictions. He talks about their poverty. And he talks about being slandered by the Jewish community. We have to talk about that. And the word for afflictions, afflictus, is to do with pressure. It's pressure points. And I think we all get this because people are feeling incredibly pressurized. So the Greek word means pressure. These afflictions are putting pressure on the Christian believers. And in our society, and even within our own ranks and in our own church, people are just feeling pressurized. They're feeling almost breathless And how are they going to cope? And it seems that work in society, and we'll come to poverty, and food poverty and financial poverty in a moment, but it's as if people are being squeezed and squeezed and squeezed, and there's hundreds of thousands of people who feel that they're at breaking point because of the pressure. And Christians are not exempt for that. Christians are just, the world has changed considerably. And it wasn't just COVID, that COVID and the change of expectations and demands upon our lives has changed considerably. But even before this, in terms of our expectations at work and people being angry and society and living in a blame culture has increased people's well-being and mental health. So that it's now off the scale. More and more people don't know where to turn to. And Jesus is saying, I understand the pressure. I understand the affliction that you're under. I've been there and I've gone through that even to the point of my own death. So please don't be discouraged. It is going to get harder for a little while longer, but I'm with you. And then the second word that's used for poverty, it's not just about having, there's two words in the Bible that's always used. And one is just having a lack of money. But the word that's used here is destitute. Real poverty. Real hardship. And that's in contrast of one of the wealthiest cities in the empire. And Christians were being persecuted and their possessions were being taken away from them. And they were really running out of resources, and people were starting to starve. And what was happening in Rome with Nero blaming the Christians, this was filtering out. And the Jewish people didn't want to get caught up in that critique, and so they decided to begin to slander the Christians. Things like about cannibalism, because Jesus said, you know, you need to eat my flesh and drink my blood, and the fact that, and then there was another thing going around it about Smyrnaeans, that they were atheists because they didn't believe in any of the Greek or the Roman gods, and so they had to be atheists. And that they didn't believe in government or authority, and so they were really seen as people who were anarchists, and the pressure was on. And Christians were feeling afflicted and pressurized. But that meant that they could hardly buy or sell or to govern their own financial lives properly. Christians were becoming poorer and poorer and poorer to the point of being destitute. And then the final area, to slander. The word is blasphemy, or people were blaspheming against them. Speaking against Jesus, speaking against their faith. And all of that was just taking its toll. It says, look, the devil who's behind all of this may well throw some of you into prison to test you. Be faithful. Be faithful. These are hard words because we live. COVID has perhaps reignited how fragile life is and reminds us how fragile. But death was a common, if you were in jail, you were probably in jail waiting to be executed. And Jesus is saying, don't be afraid, because I'm with you. And the second death that these persecutors will have to go through, you won't have to go through that. You will enter into life. Paul says, I want to know Christ and to know the power of his resurrection. I want to participate in his sufferings. I want to become like him in his death. I want to attain somehow to know what it means to be resurrected from the dead. And this is our faith. This is our journey together. It is hard being a Christian sometimes. People don't understand what we're going through. So we have all of the regular social problems that society has gone through. But then we're supposed to be worshiping a God who will look after us. And it seems that life doesn't always work out like that. And it throws us, it throws our faith, it causes us to fall into times of doubt. Jesus doesn't promise a rose garden. He's saying to the church, look, I know it's not easy. And don't be tempted into thinking it will be. But whatever you have to go through, I promise you I'll be with you all the way to the end and beyond that. Just talk about materialism for a moment. I'm really concerned about the cost of living. Deborah and I are aware that God has looked after us, and I worry about other people. I'm concerned at how hard some people have it. People are falling into real fuel poverty, and they're falling into food poverty, and our society at the lower end is beginning to crumble. And please don't see this as a political issue, but it seems as if there seems to be no political answers and to people to really understand the hardships that's going on. And Jesus, writing to this church, is reminding them that even though they have so little, that actually they are rich. Because when we have Christ, we have everything. We might not have material benefits. They thought they were poor. And Jesus saying they were rich. There's another little twist in the story in a few weeks' time. Because the Laodiceans church, those Christians there were loaded. And Jesus had to tell them that they were poor. So he tells the Smyrnans who don't have any money that they're rich. And he tells the Laodiceans who have lots of money that they're actually poor. Because God's view in life can be so different at times. The persecutions that we're going through were causing real hardship to the Christians. We need to look after each other. Come back to this point, the third point about slander. Let's not be the fifth column. The devil's hard at work slandering his people, God's people. But let's not be critical of each other. Let's not be slanderers of the people of God. Let's build one another up in the faith. Let's encourage each other. Let's move into the opposite realm. Let's hear what Jesus is saying and encourage one another, especially as this day is approaching. I know your afflictions. I know your poverty. But hear me. Hear what I'm saying. You are more rich than you could ever imagine. I know the slander of those who say they are Jews. And we need to be careful that we don't use phrases like this for our own sort of internal processing that Jews are bad people. We have to be very careful that we don't get into anti-Semitism because there was tensions in the early church. The gospel is for everyone. And we need to pray for all peoples. Particularly between the Jewish and the Arab world, that God and his greatness will make himself known. But we have to stand with those who are suffering. We have to stand with those who are struggling financially. And all of these things that have been said to this church are relevant to our day and in the world in which we live. And if you do this, I will give you a crown. The crown of victory. Smyrna was an amazing city. And as you come into the city, they built the city almost on the side of a hill. And they designed it to look like a crown. And that crown, that wreath that you could see as you come into the city, was really to put on public display the wreath of the sporting games. And so, you know, you went here for these sporting events, but as you came into it, you could see this shape, this crown, this victor's crown, in the way that the architecture and the outline of the sky had been built. And Jesus says, I will give you a crown. It's not lost in these people who felt that they were losing the race, who felt that they were faltering. And Jesus says, keep doing it, and I will give you a laurel. I'll give you a crown that will last for eternity. Blessed is a man who perseveres under trial, because when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life. More Christians have died of their faith this century than all of Christendom. And for those martyrs, they have a crown of life. But perhaps for those of us who may not actually give up our physical life, there is still a journey of hardship ahead. Please don't be discouraged at those words, because God says, I know, and I am the one who is dead and has come back to life. And with God's presence and God's power and God's enabling, we will get through this together. Paul writes to the Corinthian church, do you not know that in a race, looking at these games, that in a race all the runners run, but only the one who wins gets a prize? You get run in such a way to get that prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like someone running aimlessly. I do not fight like a boxer beating the air. No, I strike a blow to my body and I make it a slave, so that after I have preached to others, I will not be disqualified from the race. The game is on. The gauntlet has been laid down. The starting pistol is ready. And it's time for us as a church to rise up, and whatever hardships come, to look towards the perfecter and the captain of our faith. Allow me to introduce you to one of our earliest church fathers, Polycarp. Polycarp was a disciple of John the Apostle. John mentored him. We have that very clearly in church history. In fact, we have that through Polycarp's writing. Polycarp is an old man now. He now was the Bishop of Smyrna. This is after they had received this letter, a good while after. Polycarp, a disciple of John the Apostle. And don't forget, John is the recipient of these letters. So such an important connection. And Polycarp was martyred in Smyrna on the 23rd of February, AD 155. It was the time of the public games, the sporting festival. And the crowds were excited. And they were shouting in unison, away with the atheists. Away with the atheists. Let's search for Polycarp. Now, Polycarp had been told, and he could have fled the city, but he stood with the saints. He stood with his people. He stood and he says, I will not flee. That very night he had a dream that he would be burned in a fire. And he could have fled because of that dream. But his people were being persecuted. His church was under the cosh, and he stood with them. His whereabouts had been told. A slave had collapsed under torture and told him where he was, and he was arrested, and he was brought into the public games. Even the police captain who had arrested Polycarp didn't want him to die. And he said to the old man, what harm is it just to say that Caesar is Lord? What harm is it just to recant and you will have your life? And he entered the arena. And there came a voice, we're told, of saying, Polycarp, be the man. Be the man. And he was asked to recant by the proconsul. And this is what he says. 86 years I have served him. 86 years. He has done me no wrong. How can I blaspheme my king and my saviour? And this was the Sabbath, and we're told that the Jews began to gather the wood, and that would have been against all Jewish tradition to be, but they were the first to gather the wood for the pyre in order to burn Polycarp. Polycarp replies, before the flames are written, "You threaten me with fire that will only burn for a short time, but it will soon be quickly quenched. But you do not know the fire that awaits the wicked in the day of judgment. So why are you waiting? Come, do what you have to do." And together with that, he was burned alive. 1,000 years later, in the then in the early days of this new city, 1,000 Christians were persecuted. Their skulls were kept in a tower. This city knew what it was for believers to give their lives. And this great bishop was one of the first who was able to stand his ground. And Jesus says, for those of you who do, you will not experience a second death. No more death, no more mourning, no more tears, no more cancer, no more pain, no more mental illness, no more COVID. Because you will be entered into paradise. Blessed is the one who shares in the first resurrection, for the second death has no power over him. Hear what the Spirit is saying. So as I come to close this morning, here are some things for us to apply to our lives. Remember that whatever you're going through, that Jesus Christ is a victor, and he knows. Realize that Christ cares for you. It's okay as Christians, sometimes we have to relinquish our rights, even to life itself. And it's time to pray against the devil who opposes the people of God and to stand and enter into times of prayer and warfare. But remember above all things that Christ has promised us that he will be with us till the very end. And I remind us of those final words in this great letter. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the churches. So listen, tune your ear in and ask God, ask him, what is he saying to your Caleb? And let's gather that information together and go on a journey as a family. Adam, would you come and lead us in a time of worship?